Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Transitions Tuesday. This is the day that we take a look at all kinds of transitions from broad perspectives. And today we will look at a transition that we will all make at some point in our lives. And we are joined by Valerie Grant. Valerie, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much.
Now, Valerie, you are a licensed funeral director, so if anybody knows about transitions, I would say it's you. You are currently pursuing a degree in psychology. Talk about being a licensed funeral director. You are an African-American woman, and I'm not sure there are that many female African-American funeral directors.
Well, actually, that is the common myth, is that there are not a lot of women in general in funeral service, and that there are not a lot of African-American women in funeral service, when in fact, there are at nearly every funeral home that I can think of off of the top of my head in the District of Columbia, there is a woman either in position of leadership or ownership who is herself a licensed funeral director. And so it's shown to the world as if it is a man's job.
Indeed.
But there are definitely more women doing the work than most people would even imagine. So it's one of those things that it's comforting to know that, you know, it's not just a male-oriented field. Well, that women are actually dominating the field.
Well, thank you for shredding that, Matthew. We like to do that as well, so I really appreciate that, because that's a brand new piece of information, at least for me. My listeners may be a lot more informed than I. You particularly state that you are a licensed funeral director. Are there folks who represent themselves to be funeral directors who are not licensed?
Unfortunately, there are many people who will put themselves out as a funeral director, and they are not licensed. Thankfully, in the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia, we're getting a little better at weeding out those who are not licensed, but there are a number of people who put themselves out to the public as if they are licensed. You know, it's unfortunate because it's in those instances that people either end up being taken advantage of, and it's a situation where in the wrong hands, a already somber and sad situation can turn catastrophic because of a misrepresentation. So, that's definitely something that is unfortunately prevalent in the funeral industry.
What does it take to become licensed, and how does that alter your practice as a funeral director?
So in the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia, I'll speak on those because, of course, that's where I am and that's where I know the most. The requirement is that you have to graduate with an associate's degree in mortuary science from an accredited university. Following your educational accomplishments, you also have to complete an apprenticeship. There are different standards for an apprenticeship based on the jurisdiction that you're in. Some may have a certain number of hours that you have to complete. Some may have a certain number of cases, and some may combine the two. So in the District of Columbia, there's a certain number of cases that you have to complete with respect to embalming as well as with respect to directing funerals. And once you complete that apprenticeship, you have to sit for your state exam. Now, the one thing that I didn't mention is prior to graduation or shortly after graduation from an accredited university, you have to complete your national boards, which is a basically like a general exam that is taken that covers all of the 50 states. And it is set up in such a way that it shows general competence within the funeral industry. And of course, then your state exams show that you are competent and able to be compliant with the laws that are local to you. For me, in pursuing the degree of mortuary science, it was not challenging. It was not, you know, something that was too overwhelming, but it was truly a process to go through and to take the boards. And there's some people who can do their educational piece as well as their apprenticeship piece at the same time, because the law does permit that in most areas that you can do them at the same time. But I separated them out and did the degree first, and then the apprenticeship, and then the actual fully licensing. And I did all of mine through the District of Columbia, and then received my licenses for Maryland and Virginia through a process of reciprocity.
When someone is sitting and talking with a funeral director, it's reasonable to assume that they're not in the best place emotionally. Is it also reasonable for that person to ask if the director is licensed, and if so, where's the license? Do license have to be posted in the office?
Well, I would say, you know, the first and foremost, most people who come in to a funeral home, I do agree, are not necessarily in the best mental state. A death has recently occurred, and they're somewhat distraught from that. But that being said, it's almost the same as if you go into a hair salon. You don't necessarily automatically ask to see a license. The presumption is that if I walk into a funeral home, if I ask to meet with the funeral director, that I'm going to meet with somebody who's qualified according to the local regulations. So most people don't have the presence of mind to say, you know, let me see your license, or are you licensed? And, you know, in most areas, the laws regulate that you have to post up a license in an inconspicuous manner. The same as you would scan, like if you went to a nail salon or a hair salon, and you would see the license somewhere, typically in the booth of that particular service provider. The licenses are displayed, but most people just don't have the presence of mind to say, let me see the license. And even if they are shown a license, to really look at it to make sure that it's a valid license. Because like your driver's license, this occupational license expires every 2 years. And, you know, I can show you a license, but if you don't look for a current date, you may not even recognize that it's no longer an active license. So most people don't have the presence of mind to say, to ask that question, because there's also a certain level of trust that people have that if I'm going to somewhere on what I perceive to be as my worst day, nobody's going to have such a low level of morals that they're going to try to dupe me at this time in my life. So the average person does not walk into a funeral home and ask to see a license.
Short of looking at a license and reading the license, is there any way to know whether or not the person you're with is licensed?
Well, in most jurisdictions, you can go to the state's page, the licensing organization's page. So like in the District of Columbia, you can go to the Board of Funeral Directors webpage, and in Maryland, you can do the same thing. And most of them have a search engine where you can check to see if a person is licensed or if a business is properly licensed. So you can definitely do your due diligence. But again, just in that particular phase of your life where you're grieving, most people just don't think to say, let me really check. In many instances, it's, you know, we've been going here for years. Everybody that we've lost has gone through this funeral home. So the trust has been established already, and there's no unless it's been something that's in the news, or, you know, if you had an experience that was bad the last go round, there's really no gut feeling that I should check into this for most people. But there are definitely methods that you can use to check to make sure that you are dealing with a legitimate business.
So it sounds like that might even be a task for a family friend. Maybe that's a discussion to have now, to ask a friend to do that kind of due diligence when the time comes, because you're not going to.
Right, and I do agree. And I think, you know, speaking about doing things beforehand, I feel like, you know, thankfully we don't find a lot of instances where people have set up businesses without being properly licensed. There have been some, but it's not a very rampant thing. But I do believe that specifically with funeral service, it's something that we should not wait to have a conversation once somebody has passed. I believe that everybody needs to have a conversation about what they will do when that time comes, because unfortunately, we often talk in the if that time comes, but death is something that it's a when it comes. It's not, you're not going to, you know, bypass it. But because people are so uncomfortable with the concept of death and dying, it's not a common conversation. But I do definitely think that there should be some due diligence done beforehand, and perhaps, you know, done even prior to someone's death being imminent. You know, it's just, it's a necessary conversation.
Maybe it's even a conversation to have today, because I was reading one of your blogs, and you made the point that in 2013, the CDC indicated that there were almost 131,000 deaths resulting from unintentional injuries. So that
Correct.
Could happen any day, any age, any moment, and it's not just connected to, you know, my grandma's 85 and we need to start thinking about this. And you also talk about the fact that roughly 3,500 parents will experience the death of a child under the age of one.
Correct.
So we need to take these conversations, I'm thinking, in hand today.
And I absolutely agree. I know that death is not the most exciting topic for most. And I understand that there are emotions associated with even the thought of losing a loved one that we just don't want to feel. However, how many times have we seen in the news that somebody has gone out to start their day and has been killed? Right. And they didn't plan that, you know, unless we're talking of a situation of a suicide. But, you know, death happens, and it's not something that we can schedule. It's not something that we can say, you know, okay, I'm going to live until I'm 80 and then I'm going to end it. You may not make it to 40, and that is unfortunately a very blunt reality that we live in. And so I'm always a proponent for having the conversation about, you know, what happens when somebody passes. It doesn't have to be such a gory conversation of, you know, I think I may be sick, or it doesn't have to be so involved, but a conversation does need to be had, because what I see on the other end is situations where someone has passed, it's been unexpected, and everyone is up in arms about trying to determine either what should be done, what the decedent would have done, and all of that can kind of be done away with if we have these conversations. And even if you feel like you're uncomfortable having the conversation, or the person that you want to have the conversation is not comfortable with having it, to take time to write things down, have someone who would be responsible for relaying that information, it's necessary, because death is not on our time schedule.
Well, and that's true. You can be 40, you can be 80, you can be 110, or it can happen tomorrow because we really just don't know. I want to go back to the statistic that you cite in your blog about the 3,500 parents who will experience death of a child under one. What's that about?
Well, from what I was able to read with the CDC, which is where I got the information from, there's a certain percentage of parents who will experience the death of a child by SIDS. And, of course, we understand with SIDS that, you know, it's not that we did anything wrong as a parent. It's not that, you know, there was some defect with the child's health. They simply passed away. But then there's another percentage of parents who will experience the loss of a child in cases where a child is maybe born with a defect that doesn't permit them to have longevity of life. Or, unfortunately, with childhood cancers, if they develop a childhood cancer and it's unable to be treated such that the child is able to live, then they may lose a child. And so in those instances, it's a situation where, of course, with the SIDS, it's so unexpected. You know, nobody plans to lose a child. In situations where there's sickness, you know, in my opinion, I've never experienced this, but I think that it may be a harder blow to the parent because you feel like perhaps there's something that you could have done to give the child a more viable chance of not getting sick. Sometimes parents will think, you know, that perhaps the development of cancer was something that was genetic and, you know, not necessarily being in the medical field. I can't say, I don't have any research that I've looked at to defend either side of that, but there is a large percentage of people who lose children very young, and that too is something that we don't really talk about. And it can be damaging because in not talking about it, we're also uncomfortable in talking about it when it happens to somebody that we know. And so we kind of shield our own selves from having to face those emotions by somewhat detaching from the parent who's experienced the loss, which is, I understand it, but it's not necessarily fair to just not be your supportive best.
That's very true on both accounts. And of course, with sudden SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, what a nightmare. And,
exactly.
You know, I mean, that in and of itself is a trauma. So to have to think about what you want to do in terms of funeral matters, almost unspeakable grief and so hard to deal with.
Yeah. You know, fortunately, there are some funeral homes. Most funeral homes will discount the expenses that you incur as a result of the death of a child. There are some firms that, based on their caseloads and what they bring in, I guess, you know, from a financial point annually, they do provide services at no cost to families. Now, of course, in many of those cases, it's simply the professional services, not any burial-related services. So the securing of a burial plot may still fall on the family, but there are, across the country, I've come across several that don't charge anything for infants that are 12 months and younger.
Interesting. Valerie, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about a book that you wrote for children dealing with death.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I am having a conversation with Valerie Grant, who is a licensed funeral director in the District of Columbia. We will be right back. So, Valerie Grant, in addition to being a licensed funeral director and pursuing a degree in psychology, you are also an author.
Yes.
Should I comment on how many hours in the day that you have been able to find?
Well, you know, I make time, and it all kind of works out in the wash. I'm a little tired sometimes, but it works out.
So you have found a way to add a couple of hours to the 24-hour clock?
No, I wish that I could find some extra hours, but I haven't found them just yet.
Well, given that you didn't find them, somehow or other you managed to write a book specifically for children dealing with death. And I think of additional significance is that the cover is a black grandpa and a black granddaughter. And that, I think, is really important, because while there are certainly books around, they're not enough that depict persons of color, and specifically black persons.
Correct. So the book, Goodnight Granddaddy, came about for a few different reasons. First and foremost, as a funeral director, of course, I understood the need to have something that helped parents to talk with children about their emotions and how they were managing their grief when they lost a loved one. I was able to recognize that, you know, when adults lose a loved one, we're so consumed with our own grief that we leave children to meander through theirs, which is not necessarily the best option, because death is just as painful for children as it is for adults. So we need something to help them to get through that particular loss. The book was also reflective of the fact that I had recently lost my own grandfather, who actually the main character is named after, my grandfather, William Charles. We affectionately called him WC. And the little girl holds my middle name, Michelle. The books that I do are very intentional with respect to appearance as well, because as you said, they're not enough books that are marketed towards children of color to be able to have an identifier. You know, it's good for children to read, yes, but it's also good for children to read and have books that they can identify with, and have a main character that they can identify with, because oftentimes we can see that there are books that may be inclusive of race, but those children are not main factors in the book. So the book was written specifically to help children have something to identify with, but also to help parents to have a tool, if you will, to help them to talk about death with their children, which I understand is not an easy subject. But on the flip side of that, I can recall conducting a funeral where a child had not been told that her parent had died, and her posing the question to me of if the parent was deceased. And it was very uncomfortable to know that this family was so traumatized by this sudden death that they hadn't even really formally told this young child. And it was just so bizarre to me. That it instinctively I knew that there was something that needed to be done to help parents to get to a point of being able to talk with their children about death.
In Goodnight Granddaddy, what does Michelle come to? What does she come to learn and understand through the book?
So that's the genius of the book, if you will, is that in the end of the book, she mentions the fact that she's sad and she misses him. The book shows, you know, when she learns that WC passes, that she cries. However, the book leaves it very open-ended for a number of reasons. The first is that you don't want to give children too much information. So it didn't really go into, you know, how WC died. It very vaguely, and I'm very specific about doing that, vaguely said that he got sick, and that the doctors did all that they could, but they couldn't help him, and he died. It also doesn't go into funeral rite, because I recognize that there are people from all walks of life that may read this book, and I didn't want to impose my views on them with respect to religion, afterlife, death, anything like that. So it doesn't necessarily resolve into one core concept, and it doesn't, it's very reserved, even in, you know, how the family regroups or recuperates from this loss. But it was very intentional, because I wanted whoever would read this book to say, you know, we can identify with the fact that she was sad about the loss, but here's what we believe, you know, or here's what we do as a family when someone dies, or here's how we honor them. You know, unfortunately, not every situation of death resolves with that loved one really being honored. And so I didn't want to, you know, lead into that direction either. Some people may believe that once you're gone, you're gone, and we just move on. So the book doesn't really resolve into one particular theme, but it leaves it open so that whoever's reading the book with the child and helping the child through that particular loss is able to impart to them what that particular family believes with respect to death.
So it sounds like the book actually creates a safe space, if you will, for adults and children to really sort out what this thing called death actually means.
Right. And that's with the books that I write. I've published two at this point, and there's some more that are coming out. But the books that I write are geared towards dealing with different topics, but they're meant to be conversation starters, not conversation enders. So how I write the books is meant to be able to propel the parent and the child into a conversation.
What age range is Goodnight Granddaddy written for?
Goodnight Granddaddy is written specifically for children who are preschool to early elementary. What I have found is that the book has been used with older children because it just helps parents to segue into a conversation about death. So I've seen parents use it for children as young as 3, but I've seen parents use it on children as old as 12. And it really, you have to kind of know your child and be open to whatever they're going to ask with respect to death. So it's preschool to early elementary, but it doesn't necessarily have a cap. I've even sat with adults who've had a conversation about their own feelings with respect to death after reading the book. So, it's preschool to early elementary, but I've seen it used with older children.
Older and younger, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Is, in your view, is there a age range in which a child should be permitted to participate in funeral services? Is there a time when a child is simply too young and really kind of needs to be left out of that process?
I personally don't believe that a child is ever too young to be involved in the process. I've seen and I've experienced people bringing young toddlers to funerals, of course. In many of those instances, they're not even really aware of what's going on. But I don't think that children, once they're able to really understand and they're verbal, I don't think that they should be excluded from the death of a loved one. If there is a situation where a child may be fearful, I don't believe that they should be forced to attend a funeral or view a body. But I don't believe that we should ever just exclude them without allowing them to give some sort of input. Because I just feel like when we exclude them, and especially in cases where they are aware that they're being excluded, there's a certain level of fear that develops in them because the perception in my opinion, is that a child knows if you're not allowing me to see something, it's because you're protecting me from something bad. And so I just feel like in the cases where I've seen adults who in their 20s have experienced their first funeral, the level of fear and panic is so much more palpable for them. And I don't think that it would be under normal circumstances had they been exposed to death at a younger age, and had they been allowed to participate in those emotions at a younger age. Because in many cases, it's not that they've never known of the death of someone that they loved. They've just never been invited to express their emotions and have that firsthand experience with death. So I don't think that there is an age that is inappropriate to experience death.
So far, we've been talking about death from the perspective that it certainly could be an accident or an illness, sort of the typical ways in which people tend to think about a death occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, we know that what's in the news substantially more than it should be are those deaths by those murders,
right.
Those sudden, violent, completely unexplained murders. And so now that parent, that family member, that child, not only are they dealing with the loss of someone they knew and cared about, but they're also dealing with the way in which that loss occurred. How do you approach families who have been in that kind of a situation?
Well, I think first and foremost, anybody who's dealing directly with a family who has lost someone as a result of a homicide, anything that's traumatic, should be able to have in their information outlets that they can refer people to for appropriate mental health care. But I think from a professional standpoint, one of the best things that you can do is to just be patient. In situations where, if you look at in Prince George's County recently, we've experienced 3 or 4 homicides of women due to domestic violence issues.
And that's Prince George's County in Maryland.
Right.
Okay.
It begs the question of what's going on in the home. And unfortunately, with funeral service, and I guess fortunately in many instances, meeting with the family following the death of someone is probably one of the most intimate things that will occur. Because in those settings, the funeral director is required to learn so much about the family. Everything from personal history to be able to fill out a death certificate to just trying to make them comfortable as you can so that they can go through the process of planning. And so from a professional perspective, the one thing that I would say is that, be patient. Be patient as a supporter of this family. Be patient as anyone who has to interact with this family to handle any form of business, because their emotions are so on the surface. They're clearly stressed. A lot of them are not eating and sleeping properly. So all of that plays into how they are then able to interact with the public. And the more patient that you are and the more sincere that you are in being able to assist them through this process, the better it is for them. But first and foremost, being able to recognize mental health issues and when it's time for a professional to step in versus, they just need a moment to kind of cry or talk is really key because, you never know what a person's trigger is that can really send them off the deep end And the goal is to make sure that they don't drown in this situation.
The experience, the sense of sort of drowning in grief, I would say is a particular import for the loved one who's lost someone by virtue of suicide. Or something that they, which we kind of alluded to before, something that they believe they could have done to intervene. And so that person, and I'll just focus on the person who's lost someone by suicide. There are often so many myths and misconceptions about how suicides happen and don't, and what drives people. How do you, as a funeral director, deal with that person who is trying to plan a funeral for someone who has died in a way that they take responsibility for?
I think for me personally, the things that have worked best for me is to, be available to assist that person in whatever way is necessary. To an extent, of course, you as the provider don't want to overextend yourself and then propel yourself into poor mental health. But I think that the other thing is that typically in these cases, it's not a situation where the survivor comes into the funeral home alone. Typically, they have some support. And so I think that it is important for funeral directors to give communication to those who are there to support, that here are some ways that you can be helped. Here are some outlets that may be able to provide some mental health services. Because the biggest concern, I think, for anybody who is there to support an immediate survivor of someone who commits suicide is that you don't want it to be now a second suicide, or you don't want this person to bottom out and spiral out of control. So just taking enough interest in the person to give them information, but to provide their support with information, I think is the biggest help that you can give. And simply reminding the person and having their supporters to remind the person that, they did the best that they could, that it's not their fault. Of course, that becomes a little, it becomes a heavier task to take on if it's a situation where a person has left a suicide note specifically blaming someone. We definitely want to secure some mental health support for that person. But I don't think that, I think that, that from a professional perspective, we have to be careful not to be so emotionally invested that we do damage to ourselves, because then we're no good to the clients that we're going to serve.
Absolutely. Valerie Grant, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, Valerie, I note that you suggest sometimes or often that survivors write a letter to the deceased. So I'd like to pick up with that when we return. Folks, you are listening to Mind Talk, and I'm talking with Valerie M. Grant, who is the author of several books, including Goodnight Granddaddy. She's also a licensed funeral director. She's going to school. I don't know how she has time to breathe, but so hopefully she will take a breath during this break. We will be right back. Valerie Grant, certainly as a licensed funeral director, you meet with people who are at many different stages and experience of grief when they come to see you. And you often suggest that the survivor writes a letter to the deceased, not on their phone, not on their computer, but pen and pencil. Old school.
Right.
Why?
Well, I think that there is a certain level of relief that comes from being able to get out emotions. And I just feel like with respect to writing a letter, I can remember being angry as a child and writing out my thoughts in a journal. And I can also remember, even as a young adult, getting in situations where I was frustrated with someone in particular and writing them a letter. And it, in many instances, I never gave them the letter. I would destroy the letter. But my emotions felt so much more resolved once I'd done it. And then I lost a loved one and was angry about it. And the thing that helped me the most was to write a letter. In that letter, and this particular letter was several pages long, but in the letter, I was able to express everything that I felt about that person. Every time that I felt like, you know, they really showed me that they loved me, every time that I felt like I was maybe disappointed with them. But in writing that letter, it for me was as if I had had a conversation with them, that I'd had that final goodbye with them. And I felt like once I did it, you know, I was able to really not necessarily forget the person, but I was able to reinvest and move on to the next relationship or the, you know, the next set of circumstances in life. And I felt like prior to doing that, I had just been festering in my grief. And so I often do. I recommend that to people all of the time. And I recommend it on pen and paper or pencil and paper because it's something that once you destroy it, you know that it's gone. I'm not computer savvy in the least bit, but I'm certain that, you know, things that we save on tablets or that we email, even when we delete them, I'm just not a believer that they're gone. And so I recommend the pen and paper because you never want to be in a situation where, you know, you've written this letter to somebody and there are things that will really held private between you and that person. And you believe that you've destroyed or deleted the email or the note that you've written on your tablet. And then somebody is able to say, oh, no, I have it, you know, and now I'm exposing not only whatever may have been going on, but I'm opening your wound again. And you're having to relive this, but now in a totally different light. That to me, that's just not anything that I would want to even give opportunity to occur. So I do. I always recommend when people feel that there's unresolved issues and a person is no longer living, write them a letter. Destroy the letter. I specifically in my blog recommend, you know, burning the letter. For me, that is what I like to. I don't want you to think that I'm a, what is it called, a pyromaniac, but
I was getting ready to ask.
I like the process of burning candles. And even in the process of burning candles, it's symbolic of the process of burning a piece of paper. Over time, the candle dissolves. It's gone. You don't, at the end, all you get is the burnt wick. And so the same for me is with burning a letter that I may have written is that in the end it's gone and you can't get, you know, tape to put it back together because you can't put ashes back together. So I do. I always recommend writing a letter and destroying it when there are unresolved issues.
And, you know, the other piece to writing by hand is that I would suggest it affords sort of a greater catharsis because it's such a more intimate way to connect to your own feelings if mm-hmm. you're using paper and pen versus plunking away at a keyboard or doing the voice thing with a computer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's
and
much
especially
more intimate.
If you're using pen, you know, when, because we're so accustomed to using a computer, we know that we can hit delete. But if I'm using ink and paper, I'm going to give more thought to what I'm about to write because I don't want to have to, you know, if anybody's like me, I don't like to see mistakes on paper. So I'm not going to just kind of rush off and write anything because I don't want to mess up or I don't want to have to start over. So in writing, in physically writing, I give more thought to what I'm going to say.
And, you know, I would also suggest that there are no mistakes that are made in that kind of letter that's clearly written with that kind of emotional intensity. They're just mm-hmm. things that you've expressed in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
For the person who is dealing, just dealt with the information that a loved one has passed, what is the process by which they approach a funeral director or a funeral home? What should they look to do, and what kind of steps should they expect to take? What kinds of questions should they expect to answer?
Well, there are certain different, there's a few different ways that this can happen. The first is if a person passes and they are in a medical institution. In most areas, you have a time frame. So if a person passes in, say, a hospital, Maryland, I believe you have 72 hours from the time of death that a family has to make a decision on a funeral home. So you do have some time to do some homework there. However, if you're in a situation where a person has passed and they're not in a medical facility and their death does not warrant investigation by, say, a medical examiner's office, you really have to act somewhat quickly. And so in those cases, the first thing that I would say is find out if there is a method by where you can have your loved one sheltered in a facility. For instance, in the District of Columbia, if you don't know what funeral home you want to use, the medical examiner's office will shelter your loved one. However, there is an associated fee. And, you know, so it's kind of one of those things where you have to kind of think quick. But the other thing that I would say in situations where you have to think quick, if you call in a funeral home in those instances and you determine that, you know, you're not necessarily comfortable with that funeral home, they're likely going to charge you some type of fee because they've already expended their staff to receive your loved one. They've been sheltering your loved one. For me, it's my peace of mind is worth more than the fee that they may charge. And in most cases, it's no more than $300 at a true max. But, you know, it's the first thing that you should think about is cost. And it sounds, you know, crazy to say put a price on it, but that is the first thing that you should think about, because if you're going somewhere where they're going to charge you an astronomical rate, the thing that we forget is that once this person is buried or once this person is cremated or once we've done whatever final rite we're going to do, we as survivors still have to live. And so if I've expended far too much money that I maybe didn't have in showing this decedent who really can't even experience my love for them through the care I've provided with respect to funeral home, it's not really worth it. So the first thing is cost. The second is, you know, from a professional standpoint, do they meet all of your markers? Everybody has individual markers of what they need for something or some institution to provide for them. So if it's that, you know, I simply need you to do cremation, I'm not really worried about if you as a director give me warm and fuzzy feelings, I just need to make sure that you cremate my loved one, then, you know, you can find places that will do that for a very low fee. But the thing that we have to focus on is cost and comfort level. If a place just doesn't make you feel comfortable, tell them, you know, I need a minute to determine what we're going to do, get some insight, and then make a decision. But I think what hurts families the most, they make very rushed decisions.
Yes.
And it's not, you know, the thing to remember is your loved one is deceased. So time for them has stopped. There's no need to now rush this and make rash decisions when you can really take your time within reason. I mean, you know, we're not talking months here, but you can take your time. The funeral doesn't have to happen within 2 or 3 days unless those are religious beliefs. And typically in those circumstances, they already have their funeral homes that they know that they go to. Those funeral homes are accustomed to their cultures and they meet their needs. But if you're not in one of those religions that you have to have burial within a certain number of hours, take your time. You know, your supporters will understand if you needed to take a moment to do some due diligence. Typically, you know, you can get most of what you need in about a day or so. So take that time to make a good decision, and then reach out for help. You know, if you have people who are willing to help you with processing funeral homes to find out, you know, what the cost is going to be for this, use those people to help you to then, you know, make a decision. Input is good to a point when it comes to supporters who really just want to help you.
Is there an average cost of a funeral? I mean, on some levels, I think that's kind of a silly question because folks can go all out or go all under in terms of, you know, dealing with funeral. But in your experience within the tri-state area of Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, is there an average cost?
I would say that in this area, the range is kind of big because, as you say, you know, you can go all out or you can go all under. But, you know, if you're spending anywhere from roughly $4,500 to $8,500, you're within the range. And like I said, I know that that's a huge range. The thing that I often tell people is if you're looking for service and professionalism, which you really should be, you're going to have to pay for what it is that you need. So, you know, we're no longer in the day of the $2,500 funeral being, on average, the extremely pomp and circumstance, uber professional type of service. Now, there are some new funeral homes that are, you know, developing their clientele, and they're able to meet those needs. They're very professional in meeting those needs, but they're not always able to be at your beck and call, if you will. The thing to take into consideration is if you feel like you're being price gouged, you probably are. You know, if you're paying $15,000 for something and there's no service behind it, run. Okay. But it really, there's such a wide variety of what can be done with respect to a funeral that to say, oh yeah, if you pay more than $7,000, you're paying too much, you can't really say that.
Gotcha.
Because you get into so many things that are able to be custom, from programs to if you're going to do a long newspaper notice, which will cost. So it can definitely fluctuate greatly, but a good funeral home will be able to assist you in coming close to whatever your price point is, and still provide you with good service.
So it sounds like perhaps even today you want to start thinking about what that price point is for you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, people have to factor that in. One of the things that I often remind people of, and because they'll say, you know, oh, I have life insurance and I have a policy that's worth, you know, X amount of dollars. Life insurance is not a guarantee that somebody's going to pay for your funeral. The law currently does not require a beneficiary to use benefits for the sake of burial expense. That is definitely a common misconception with respect to life insurance. So, you know, you can find a funeral home. Most funeral homes, you're allowed to go in and do pre-need arrangements. I definitely say, you know, look into that.
Okay. I didn't realize that there was no law requiring. So I could, for example, be the recipient of a $200,000 life insurance policy and decide that I'm not going to use it for a family member, and that's legal.
Yes.
I think we're going to have another conversation.
Yes, because unless you have specific burial insurance, a life insurance policy is just benefits that are paid to the person that you assign at the time of your passing.
Do you recommend burial insurance?
You can get specific burial insurance. You can find an agent that will be able to provide you with burial specific insurance. And then, like I said, you can always pre-plan with a funeral home. And most funeral homes, what they'll allow you to do is you can pick out your arrangements. You can pay whatever that cost is. And in many instances, they will guarantee the pricing so that if you pay, say, $6,000 now, but you pass away 30 years from now, it's still at that $6,000 price.
Okay.
So, yeah, you can definitely do that. And then there are clauses or there are laws that are set up. I know specifically, like in Maryland, if a funeral home, say, closes before you're passing, they should have put your money into a secure method of funding so that that money is still there for you. And then you just decide on what funeral home you want it transferred to. And it goes to that funeral home. Now, whether or not they still honor the pricing is another issue, but the money is still there. But Maryland has a fund set up that funeral homes have to pay into, that if the funeral home misappropriates their money and there is no money from your pre-need there at the time of your passing, there's a fund that will assist with paying for the funeral, so long as the family is able to provide the documents showing that they entered into a contractual agreement with that funeral home and that they paid whatever the amount was to that funeral home.
Interesting. Valerie, tell folks how to be in touch with you. I'm guessing there are still more questions to be answered.
So you can always visit my website. I have two websites that are up. One that is the blog that deals with death is www.thedayafterdeath.com. And then you can reach me by going through my book website, which is www.valmgrant.com. And then you can also email me at ValmGrant@AOL.com.
Okay. ValmGrant@AOL.com. You may be getting a couple of emails. I'm just saying. Val, I got to thank you so much for spending time with us today and sharing all of this important information with our Mind Talk listeners. Thank you.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which comes to you daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical or mental health or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And remember, if you want to be in touch with me, the easiest thing to do is to go to the mindtalk.org website. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. Take care.